podcast if you want to view it afterwards, subject to no technical difficulties. And our speakers will be speaking for 15 minutes, and then there will be time for questions. But as you, there'll be microphones going around so you can speak your questions into the microphone so that we can record them, please. And I want to say that I think care is probably the most important issue that we're dealing with at the moment. And these are some of the experts, I'd say, globally, who are working on this issue. So I'm going to introduce them in order from this end. Firstly, Dr. Lydia Hayes, who's a lecturer in law at Cardiff University and specialises in minimum labour standards, formulations, enforcement and violation. And the reason we're doing this event is that Lydia wrote this fantastic book, Stories of Care, A Labour of Law, Gender and Class at Work, which is absolutely brilliant. And Nikki and I actually heard Lydia present this last year and were really overwhelmed by it and thought we've got to get her to LSE. It's really, really important that this work is known and that it has a really, really good circulation because it links together gender, very importantly, through law to labour and to care. Really, really important connections made across. So I do thoroughly recommend that book. Then next on the table, along the table, is Kevin Lucas, who's the regional manager at Unison, who's running an incredibly important campaign, the Care Workers Campaign. It's really important that we're all connected together, I think, academic research and action on care workers. So we're really grateful that he's come along tonight to talk to us about the key issues of that campaign. Then next is Professor Nikki Lacey, who many of you may know. She's the School Professor of Law, Gender and Social Policy. Nicola's been doing research in criminal law and criminal justice for a long time and is certainly a lot of people's feminist heroine, including Lydia's actually and mine, so we're all very, very pleased that we have one of the key feminist legal experts in the room. And then at the end is Dr. Insa Cock, who's Assistant Professor of Law at the LSE and who's interested in bringing anthropology into dialogue with criminology, legal theory and socio-legal studies. Now, Insa's written a book that I really wanted to show everybody, at least the manuscript. It's coming out in September. It doesn't yet have a title, but it's going to be about care, citizenship and the state. And from what she's written so far, it looks really, really interesting. So I'm just going to give a very brief introduction because I began many, many years ago doing my initial research with care workers on caring education and then had a terrible experience more recently. So I'll begin with that and then we'll go on to Lydia. So I begin with the story of my mum. My mum died as a result of financialisation of the caring services. There was actually no provision whatsoever to look after her. This meant that at night there wasn't any care for her. She was severely disabled, needed feeding, needed lifting out of bed, and it took more than me to be able to provide care for her. There literally wasn't any. There wasn't any because I found out eventually most of the care homes had been subject to financialisation taken over by private equity companies. And that basically they could not make enough profit from my mother. She had too many needs. She needed too much care. She wasn't profitable. Finding decent daily care even was an issue because those available in the region where we lived were actually described as not fit for your worst enemy or for dogs. And I wasn't prepared to put my mother in a home like that. So the provision of care for me is one of the absolute key issues. And you can see from this, there's an estimated 1.2 million people at the moment in this country with unmet care needs, maybe even more. Kevin will tell us more. More than 100 care home businesses have collapsed since 2010, 380 declared insolvent. And you probably can read the rest for yourselves. But the real key issue here, and the issue that infuriates me drives me and actually makes me sick to the core is the fact that the majority of care homes now are owned by private equity companies. These private equity companies want a guaranteed rate of 12% annum profit. 12% is a huge profit on anything. Maximum profit. And as the fantastic study, and I've put the link there, which is basically a follow the money study by the Cresc Research Council in Manchester. The follow the money study found that finance uses, and Kevin, I hope, will elaborate on this, uses care homes for two reasons. One, just to extract the maximum money that it can from them without any care about who's needs care. And the second one is to actually use them for debt loading so that they can actually function to buy other businesses, make more profit and keep increasing their debt. What's significant, I think, is when these homes collapse, which they often do because trying to effect 12% profit from them, it means that the state pays. So effectively, these private equity companies are using the state as an ATM. They make high-risk decisions about debt, about profit. When they fail, the state bails them out and literally gives them the cash to survive. There are a huge number of job vacancies in social care that cannot be filled, which also adds to the lack of provision. And really, I want to argue very strongly, this is neglect by design. This is about the state supporting private equity, and it actually kills people purposefully. So over to Lydia now. Thank you.
Powerful introduction, thank you, Bev. The way things are going, the basic tenets of the post-war social care settlement between the state and the British people, in which the state carries responsibility for meeting care needs, is unlikely to survive the next few years. As Bev says, Age UK estimates that 1.2 million people are not getting the help they need with the basics of life, getting out of bed, getting fed, using the toilet. And the question around which this event is framed is what happens when this most basic human activity is turned into a for-profit activity. Now, others are going to concentrate on matters of finance and labour. My particular contribution relates to law and the law as it pertains to care employment in particular. State support for social care provision as we know it is marked by chronic underfunding and antipathy. Yet it can't continue in its current form because paid care work is subject to persistent degradations of sexism and class bias, which undermine the very fabric of what we understand social care to mean. So what is social care? In my work, social care is the antithesis of political conceptions in which care is regarded as a private matter into which the state mustn't ordinarily intrude, a private matter for families, for women within families in particular. Social care is a consequence of care which has been socialised, and it's a political achievement that changed the life opportunities of men and women in the UK and has been essential for the 20th century liberation of women. So I want to begin by saying something not about profit, but about privatisation. And the significance is that privatisation comes before profit as the accumulation of private interests. Now, even though family life is shaped by the state in relation to education, taxation, housing policy, welfare, etc., it's commonplace to regard domestic homes as being private spaces where people live so-called private lives. And similarly, despite state investment in schools, education, transport, roads, and an infrastructure in which privately owned businesses are able to thrive, economic markets are considered to be private because they stand in contradistinction from the state. So the privatisation of social care mixes up the economically private realm of the market with the private social sphere of the home and family. And the organisational processes through which care have been privatised have transferred resources, billions and billions of pounds worth of public money, the labour of care workers and their expertise and their skills and their experience. This has all been moved from public organisations to non-public organisations, which are mainly privately owned. Private sector organisations dominate the care landscape, but on occasions, local authorities have given commercial contracts to so-called not-for-profit social enterprises or voluntary organisations. And this has given the term independent sector as the collective noun for the non-public organisations that deliver care. And by drawing attention to the independence of non-public provision, that term independent tends to deflect attention away from the private economic interests which are served when public sector services are contracted out. And the collective noun independent suggests that in the hands of these purported autonomous and free-thinking providers, services are somehow liberated. Yet independent is a very strange word to use for organisations that depend upon billions of pounds worth of taxpayers' money. Now, charitable and not-for-profit organisations, yes, they have a different ethos from private organisations, but in respect of social care, they bear a remarkable asymmetry. They are all holders of commercial contracts. They engage in competitive tendering. Private sector, social enterprise, and charitable organisations populate this independent sector, and this has been strategically positioned by successive governments to compete with the private sector. In care, competition over contracts is a competition over labour costs, and this is a competition in which the independent sector has won hands down. The care workforce of today is employed in jobs which carry less than half of the financial value of care workers' jobs that they were in 20 years ago, because occupational pensions have gone, sick pay schemes have gone, holiday payments have gone, hourly wages have been absolutely slashed, unpaid working time is now routine. And we can ask, how could this possibly happen? It's happened because the independence of the independent sector rests in its legal capacity to independently locate the employment of care workers at the margins of the labour market. Its primary distinguishing feature, I would argue, is its legal independence to employ care workers on lower pay and to be able to eliminate the cost of protecting care workers from the economic impacts of sexism. So the inadequacy of employment regulation is very important for understanding what has happened in the care sector in recent years and how it's happened. Almost 1 million adults currently have given up paid work within the labour force to care for friends and relatives, and they've done this because care provision is inadequate and they are exiting the labour market. Meanwhile, women who are paid to provide social care have faced a regressive, sexist and systematic subordination of their interests as women and because they are women. So my book, Stories of Care, is based on the experiences of 30 home care workers from the same city in the south of England. And in it, I use the words and the stories of care workers as a tool to illuminate their working lives and to try and understand how labour law makes those working lives material. So what they share with me is a very distinctive source of knowledge about law and its impact on society. Now, saying something meaningful on the basis of those accounts of those care workers is so important because there are few better examples of the contempt in which the state holds working class women than the way in which the social care workforce has been treated, particularly over the past decade. So what I'm doing in each chapter of the book is showing how the participation of care workers is constructed in a way in which they are judged and regarded as being inferior labour market participants, not only by judges in courts of law, but by politicians, by legislators, by policymakers, by the government, by employers, and by the media. And what I show in the book is how these judgments of inferiority are legitimated by legal provisions and judicial doctrine. And that's because the law provides a body of reasoning in which care workers are inferior, where they do supposedly deserve less, where they are markedly different from other workers, where they do have to meet different tests of entitlement to other types of workers, where they're not proper because they do women's work. So chapter by chapter in the book, I'm arguing that the UK's crisis in social care is co-implicated with a gendered injustice in relation to inadequate labour law. So the first chapter of the book, and there are some little videos which are on my website, which is at storiesofcare.com, and each of the words has got a hyphen between them. So if you want to see those, you can find out more there. But the first character narrative that I draw together in the book in chapter one is the character narrative of cheap nurse. And cheap nurse is the collection of stories that care workers told me about low pay, about being assumed to lack distinct skills. And I set this character narrative in the historic context of the development of care services and the evolution of equal pay law since the 1970s, because equal pay law has done very little for women who do not work in jobs where men also work. In fact, equal pay law has incentivized and justified the privatization of care services. In chapter two, I discuss the range of stories that are told under the heading of To a Penny. This is the character who narrates stories about insecure work, about the damage that is done to women's self-confidence and to their family lives by working on 0 hours contracts, and critically, by being permanently fearful of instant dismissal. It's about them being tricked into taking jobs on false pretenses, about working without any perceivable barrier between their availability for work and when they know they're able to rest, of being shortchanged on wages. And it's from this perspective that I look at employment protection law, unfair dismissal provisions, and also 2P provisions, which are supposed to protect workers when they're employer transfers from the ownership of one organisation to another. Well, employment protection law does not protect the jobs which are occupied typically by care workers. And I show that this is mainly because they are working class women and the law is not really designed to protect them. Employment protection law is designed to facilitate the stability of typically male employment in ways which reflect notions of female inferiority. The next character narrative is that of Mother Superior, and she narrates care workers' stories about working for love rather than money. This is because care workers are so horrified at what is happening within their occupations that they distance themselves emotionally and intellectually from issues to do with inadequate care and abuse. And they do so, as they did in my study, by positioning themselves as being dedicated carers, not like these other care workers who don't care about the service users or are abusive of clients. And the way in which care workers communicated this was by talking about their pride in working without pay, because they really did care. So I'm able to discuss this story in relation to national minimum wage law and about the way in which national minimum wage law is not serving the economic interests of care workers, and indeed care workers are positioned differently in relation to the national minimum wage. In the final chapter, I look at a character that I call Choosy Susie. And Choosy Susie is the narratives of care workers who are self-employed or are working as personal assistants. And I look at the way in which a discourse of choice and personalisation is actually acting against the rights-bearing status of women in the care sector. Now, the women I spoke with recognised that they were unjustly treated, and they talked about what it means to be a care worker, something about the ontology of care work. And I identified that care workers as a group have been subjected to something that I term institutionalised humiliation, and this really centre stages the role of the state. At the centre of this institutionalised humiliation is the failure of the state to protect care workers from sex discrimination in the economic organisation of their work. So the structural exclusion of care workers through privatisation from the benefit of equal pay rights is key to their economic deprivation. At their next level, humiliation is supported by the underprotection of care employment in law, in which employment protection law explicitly declines to value forms of employment in which care workers are typically engaged. For example, casualised, 0 hours contracts, or jobs in which you don't stay in the job for long periods of time. In a third dimension, the humiliation of care workers is exemplified by the operation of the national minimum wage, which requires care workers to work without pay as a legitimate basis of their contract, and it denies them full recognition of their labour as work. And finally, in the reorganisation of the state, we see in the Care Act in England, the Care Act 2014, that the craft of paid caregiving is being erased in preference for a regressive representation of caregiving in domestic spaces. So what I argue is that the 21st century crisis of social care is a product of a gendered crisis in the regulation of work. It's remedying this is a goal. Remedying the problems in social care is a goal which can't be achieved without a significant change to law at work, in which care work is properly recognised and valued. So the future strength of social care provision relies upon public conversations such as this, in which questions about the value of women's contribution to the economy in general and the value which is placed on their labour is connected with a concern about chronic underfunding of care provision. Changes to the world of work, to the economy, to the role of the state, and to the structure of families exemplify that social care is a critical public and political issue, and its erosion demands a vocal response from the public at large. The creation of state-led care markets has highlighted that without adequate attention to the realisation of labour standards which apply universally and the importance of collective bargaining, sexism and class bias are reconstituted in the labour market and continue to be justified in law. Thank you. I just wanted to say that I've written a publication for the Institute of Employment Rights, which is about the importance of sectoral collective bargaining in care, and I've brought some copies with me, which I've put at the front of the stage, if anybody would be interested in that at the end of the talk. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. And firstly, can I start by saying what a privilege it is to be here today and to have the opportunity to speak, especially on May Day. And I hope to help give voice to some of the 210,000 social care workers who work in the North West, where my union region is based. So I'm a regional manager with Unison North West, but I'm also the coordinator of the Care Workers for Change campaign. A campaign that seeks to support care workers to form workplace trade unions and develop the political and community alliances to win dignity in social care through fair funding, decent jobs and quality services. And here's just a few images, a snapshot of some of our campaign activity over recent months by and for care workers. It's a very ambitious campaign. It's one that, frankly, I could talk about all day. But my main purpose for being here today is to talk you through a case study of a particular care worker that I've been working with for some time. And I'm going to call her Anne. It's not a real name. Not because she's a vulnerable woman, she's not, she's a very strong woman, but she's in precarious employment and we have a responsibility towards protecting her hours of work. So Anne, who works in Tameside, which is a borough of Greater Manchester, and once upon a time she would have been directly employed by the town hall, by the council, to provide home care for the elderly and vulnerable of Tameside, and would have been on nationally bargained, equality-proofed, trade union-recognised terms and conditions of employment. Today, like all councils, Tameside outsourced that work, commissions private providers. And in the case of Tameside, there's 9 different private providers providing home care in the Tameside area. And the employer for Anne is called Careline. Now, until October 2016, the employer was Mears, a very large corporate organisation, Mears. Mm-hmm. And I think the best way to get a sense of what is of the working reality for a care worker is actually to have a look at their roster. And this is a roster. This is one of Anne's rosters from the time when she worked for Mears. I don't expect you to be able to see all the detail, but I'm going to run you through it. Obviously, it's heavily redacted. Some of the scribbles are Anne's, some of them are mine, and the big coloured chunks actually cover the names and personal details of some of the clients. But to talk you through it, this is a 3-day roster, and it begins at 7:30 with a 17-minute personal care visit at the top there. Because if it's 7:30, I imagine the role in those 17 minutes is to get the client out of bed, to help them wash, to get them clothed, to help them use the toilet, the bathroom, and then probably to feed them breakfast as well in that 17 minutes. The second visit is a 13-minute personal care visit, which also requires the dispensation of medication in that 13 minutes, followed by another 30-minute personal care visit, and then by 9 o'clock, the roster is already going into panic mode about all the other jobs that need fitting in that day, because 9 o'clock is Anne's first 5-minute personal care visit. 9:18, she has a 10-minute personal care visit with medication to be dispensed as well, and then 9:38, the low point of this roster, 9:38 to 9:39 is a 1-minute personal care visit. What can anyone do for an elderly, vulnerable person in 1 minute? Yeah, it is there in black and white on the roster. Towards the bottom of the first sheet highlights a second problem with these arrangements. That is the 16th visit of the day. A 16th visit ends at 13:55. The 17th visit of the day starts at 13:55. and the following 32 visits of that day include no provision whatsoever for the travel time between clients' homes. So Anne has to leave a house, get into a car, drive to the next home, which can be a few miles away, park, get out of the car, travel and get access to the home, and all that within these small slots of time, which for those 32 are all between 5 and 30 minutes. The majority of them are 15 minutes. So what this roster does and what social care, home care providers require is for care workers such as Anne's to cut their call short. It's called call clipping, to clip their calls to enable them to get to the next individual on time. And Anne continues to clip her calls, 48 calls during that day, right through till 20 past midnight on Friday night. She then has 2 hours, 40 minutes rest break before the green block, which is Saturday, before the green block starts at 3 a.m. Saturday morning. Now, I've been a trade union official for 20 years, and I don't know of another sector where an employer could get away with requiring a worker to do that. So she starts at 3 o'clock in the morning, and then, again, call clips her way through a further 51 visits to take her through till 11:45 on the Saturday night. There's then a 4-hour, 45-minute rest period before she starts again on Sunday, which is the red block, at 4:30 in the morning, and call clips her way through 44 visits before she gets to 5 past 11 on that night. So the summary of her 3-day week is 16-hour, 50-minutes, 48 visits, followed by 51 visits, followed by 44 visits. And this roster and this individual we came across when we were pursuing national minimum wage claims against her employer. And in fact, the people who pursued and saw those to a successful conclusion are sat at the back, Kate and Matt. And what we were doing is getting Anne and her colleagues, around 20 of her colleagues, to record in fine detail, to log every minute that they worked throughout a day so that we could build evidence of the failure to pay minimum wage for that period of time. And shortly into that process, Anne's employer changed. Mears decided they weren't going to work in the north of England anymore. They didn't like us. And they threw back the keys and Careline took over. And although Careline did do away with some of the worst excesses of those rosters, it did away with the 3 a.m. starts and all this craziness. The absence of travel time between appointments, the failure to pay for travel time between appointments, and the expectation of call clipping continued. And we averaged most of those workers over that period of 12 weeks to be earning less than £5 an hour for that work. One of Anne's colleagues was earning as low as £4.30 an hour for that work. And when you ask them, as I did, why on earth would you do that? Why would any worker put up with that? And why would any human be complicit in that standard of care? And of course, the answer is 0 hours contracts. And Anne and her colleagues know to their cost that if they raise their concerns about 1-minute visits, about call clippings, about the absence of travel time, they will lose their hours. They will lose their income for subsequent weeks. So who is Careline? Well, Careline is one of around 30 companies owned by City and County Healthcare, probably the biggest home care provider you've never heard of. It's actually the largest provider of home care services in the country. Made a profit in 2016 of £13 million. City and County Healthcare itself is owned by Graphite Capital, a private equity company with an annual revenue of £124 million. Now, City and County were able to expand as rapidly as they did thanks to £65 million worth of offshore loans made by their private equity parent company, Graphite Capital. And Graphite Capital makes its money by charging an eye-watering 15% interest on those loans. Now, compare that to standard interest levels in the market currently is absolutely obscene. But that's how they make their money. And so every year, the 15% is added, but not paid for, and this is key, not paid by City and County, but added to the original debt. So very quickly, that £65 million can become £75 million. And that's important because unlike other sources of income, if Graphite, for example, were to be issuing and selling shares, then the profits of that would be taxed. Interest payments on debt is tax deductible. So that can be taken off the profits being made by City and County Healthcare. And over the period 2013 to 2016, Graphite Capital successfully added £17 million worth of new debt onto city and county healthcare. Now, Graphite will get that money back after it is expanded and expanded and expanded, built that debt up to a level where it becomes so unsustainable that Graphite decides to sell the company, and it will be bought by another private equity company who will restructure that debt and keep doing it. But at that point, Graphite Capital will walk away with the £65 million originally and whatever additional debt it's managed to accumulate. So £17 million just 3 years, not a bad return for a sector that's so desperately underfunded. I'm sure you'll agree. So who's investing in the exploitation of the vulnerable and the working women of Tameside? Well, mostly we wouldn't know, because the big investors in this system are registered in very, very secretive tax havens. In Graphite Capital case, most of the big investors are registered from Samoa. But not all investors are quite so savvy at covering their tracks. And another investor in Graphite Capital is the Church of England, would you believe?
No.
The Church of England. But before us trade unionists get too smug, another investor is the Greater Manchester Pension Fund, which is the pension holder, the pension provider for local authority workers in Greater Manchester. Yeah. This financial system is so opaque, so difficult to understand, that they're managing to get public sector workers investing in their own exploitation. And obviously, that's something we're working on, believe me, and we don't hope that's going to be the case much longer, but it gives an indication of how the structure works. So just how extensive is this involvement of private equity? Well, these are five of the largest providers of social care in the UK listed up there, and every single one of them is owned by private equity. And private equity aren't interested in operating social care within the UK because they care about our loved ones and the elderly and the vulnerable people. They're doing it because it provides a very reliable, stable source of income for them, which they are able to then drive down the standards sufficiently through unlawfully low pay, through reducing standards, through call clipping, for a failure to train their staff, through the understaffing. They reduce the standards so much they can get costs down to enable them to repay the 12% that was mentioned earlier, to get the 12% return. And to put that into context, big supermarkets would expect a 2 or 3% return. These people are screwing the sector for 12%. Excuse me. So, the system they've managed to create, it would almost impress me if it weren't for the fact that it is the money's involved. We see there 1.3 billion, which can be very easily identified as money being extracted from the social care sector. It's these kind of levels of money being extracted that is taking our social care sector to the brink of collapse. It also shows the absolute brutal exploitation of a corporate class on the predominantly working class women who provide the service and also who rely upon that service later on in life. So what are the solutions? Well, firstly, we can't simply throw more money at this system. It is a broken, corrupt system, and more money would simply mean more profits for those private equity providers. We can and we do run national minimum wage compliance claims, and Unison does so very successfully. At any one time, we'll be pursuing hundreds of claims on behalf of working women in social care, and we win them. And many of those members will get thousands, if not tens of thousands of pounds. But those wins don't challenge this structure and the employment relations within social care. We can insist on minimum standards being enshrined within commissioning, and we do so. We've been doing so for a number of years at Unison, and we've done so very successfully recently through our Unison Ethical Care Charter. And I can give you three very recent examples. So in the Northwest, in October of last year, Salford Council wrote into the contract for every home care provider that they must pay a minimum of £8.30 an hour to every privatised home care worker. In April of this year, Manchester City announced that every private home care provider in Manchester must pay the real living wage of a minimum of £8.75 an hour for every home care worker. And best of all, Tameside, where Anne and her colleagues works, have recently announced that from January the 1st, every privatised home care provider will have to pay a minimum of £9 an hour. They will end 15 minutes and less, and they will ensure that every worker is offered contractual hours as an alternative to 0 hours. Now, these are fantastic wins for the workers, but in every one of those cases, the increased cost of those improved terms and conditions is being borne by the local authority. The council is increasing the funding to enable the providers to give that. It is not touching the structure of the companies, and it is not touching the profiteering and the defunding of private equity companies. So in my mind, the only way to improve the standards within social care is to remove private equity from UK social care, remove all private interest from UK social care, and return the provision to the public sector, including national pay bargaining and including strong unions, so that workers have the collective strength and confidence to speak out when they see abuse, to whistleblow when they see elderly and vulnerable people being exploited and being let down, to drive up standards and to ensure that every single penny of social care spending goes on providing dignity in social care through fair funding, decent jobs and through quality services. Thank you. If you want to follow the work of our campaign in the North West, then there's various social media links there. And as well as the CRES report, which has already been mentioned, which is fantastic, it's quite long, so set yourself some time, but it is absolutely fantastic. A much shorter and also brilliant report is this Corporate Watch report, the home care business, which is where we found the information about city and county, and there's lots of other information there. So that's openly available on the web. Thanks very much.
Wow, thank you. Oh, well, over to Nikki now. Thank you so much, Kevin. That was a bit of a shock. I think I'm in shock, actually. Now, I've read the CRESC report, so good grief. I had no idea. No idea it was quite as bad as that.
Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Well, yeah. I have three very hard acts to follow. I'm before another one. I'm glad I don't have to follow. So I'm really delighted to be here and to talk about this very important issue. My name's Nikki Lacey, and I'm in the law department here, and I'm speaking tonight. I'm basically a criminal lawyer, but I've always been interested, ever since I've been an academic, in equality law, both because I'm a feminist and just because I'm generally interested in the ways in which law can, even when it's trying to do the right thing and enhance justice, can disguise inequalities of power that it implicitly furthers. And I think in that respect, Lydia's book, if I may say so, is an absolutely paradigm example of the best sort of scholarship that makes that dynamic of the law palpable and incredibly readable, and I really encourage everybody to read it. But I also am speaking tonight as someone who has significant care responsibilities, like many of us, I'm sure, in the room. So I both engage in care work myself, and I employ, I'm a very privileged person, I'm able to employ home care workers. And I very swiftly worked out that that's what I needed to do if I was going to actually keep my career. But of course, that is not an option available to everybody. And this is just a huge, huge issue. So I start from, you know, basic agreement with everything that has been said. And really, the current situation is just appalling. And in fact, a couple of years ago, I had the pleasure of being part of a commission on gender inequality and power that we had here at LSE, which looked at the economy, legal issues, politics. And one of our main provisions, and I've just popped it up here, was the advocacy of a national care service. There's just absolutely no reason in principle why care needs and entitlement should be any less recognised as a public responsibility than, say, health. And of course, the failure to create any such provision is apart from the various problems we've heard about already, causing enormous problems for the health service now. But, or you know, education, that care should be up there with these other other public goods. And I entirely agree with Lydia puts it beautifully in her book when she says anyone who's concerned about care of the elderly and disabled ought to put centre stage a concern for poor quality jobs and the disrespect of home care workers through this mechanism, which she's eloquently called institutionalised humiliation. And we really have a sort of totally inadequate and indeed discriminatory regime of legal regulation. I also absolutely acknowledge the hatefulness of this profit system that has been allowed to develop. But I do want to just suggest that we think for a moment a little bit about the critique of marketisation of care services. Just thinking a bit about whether marketisation is the whole problem. So backtrack a little bit. Let's just remind ourselves of that the question of care has long been a sort of really major preoccupation of the women's movement and of various, feminist schools of thought. And in particular, there was a very big debate, which many of you will remember, I'm sure, about 30 years ago around the work of a psychologist called Carol Gilligan, who really, as a way of criticising a lot of the models of development, of moral, so-called moral development, that are used by social psychologists, pointed out that, what social psychologists were using as a model of sophisticated moral development was the person who parsed any difficult, practical moral question by saying, okay, here are the interests involved, that one's more interest or the values involved, this one's more interesting, more important than the other, there's a hierarchy, therefore, that person has a right to do that and somebody else has a duty to let it happen. And she argued empirically, and this was extremely controversial because the results were very difficult to replicate, that there was a gender difference in the way in which people, on average, construed those kinds of moral problems, and that women, on average, were more likely to, instead of coming out with a very clear sort of hierarchy of values leading to a clear conclusion about what was right to do in terms of a framework of rights and duties, were more inclined to resist coming to a clear conclusion and try to work through relationships, responsibilities, a sort of way of thinking about the world and how we ought to behave, which Gilligan famously called the ethic of care. And quite apart from the question of empirically whether that association was right, this generated then a very big debate about whether we should, in a sense, reconstruct, we should revalue the care dimension by reconstructing it in terms of rights and duties, or whether that would be, in some sense, dilute something precious. And I think this relates to our debate, because I think there is a real issue here about just basically, even leaving aside the privatisation and this horrible profit framework that has been allowed to develop, it's really, there's a core issue here about how we value this work, which is, as Lydia has and Bev have both pointed out, massively inflected by both gender and class. So I'm a little bit worried, in a way, about the idea that any market in care or even any sort of commodification, commodification is a slippery word. The question, to my mind, is really about how we control and regulate that commodification and how we think about the value of the work that underlies this issue and the needs that need to be met. I think at the moment it's very hard to imagine. We live in very complex societies with, for better or worse, great divisions of labour. There is always going to be a market in care. It was already a market when it was provided more often by social providers. And that was a much better situation. Of course it was, because there was collective bargaining, there was job security, and there was, more a more robust public recognition that this was a public good that needed to be met, just in the same way as health and education. But as Lydia very honestly acknowledges in her book, the way the labour market was structured under, even when there was more genuinely public provision, if I can put it in that way, was not a panacea. It was a lot better, but many of the prejudices, many of the devaluations of this highly gendered and classed work were there. And when you say, I mean, the only thing I would slightly take issue with you, Lydia, on in terms of what you said tonight was when you said that, you know, it was a structure of equal pay law that allowed, that in a sense facilitated contracting out. And that is true because it was a claim, you know, were claims that care workers weren't being paid equally because of the bonus system that made local authorities very tempted to just, you know, get rid of this problem by contracting out. But that only happened because of sexism and classism and the failure to properly evaluate this work. So I wouldn't like us to think that if in some magical world we could go back to entirely public provision, that we would get rid of the problems that you've been talking about these private equity firms creaming off outrageous, hateful amounts of profit from this sector. But we wouldn't, I think, necessarily be getting rid of that fundamental thing. And so I just had a little, you know, think to myself about how we value care work. And I think one of the issues here is how we define skilled and unskilled labour. I mean, this is a very big issue. Of course, part of how equal pay law has come to work is through job evaluation schemes and the whole kind of industry, and it's concretized in institutions like this one with HR departments, and it's all actually meant to be about making things more fair and predictable. But actually, one of the problems is that it formalizes the concept of skill. It puts it in things that can be, in a sense, objectively measured, like education outcomes or length of time in certain kinds of jobs or that kind of thing. And actually, when I sat and thought, you know, what are the things I really need to look after my mum properly that I constantly fall down on, and the carers I employ to help with her do much better than I do on in many ways, they're very often qualities, things like kindness, diplomacy, tact, patience, unselfishness. They're sort of characteristics that don't really fit with those sort of HR type, you know, tick boxes, essential job requirements. There are ones that I think could be formalised better. I mean, negotiating skills are a key part of how to manage somebody's needs when they have complex intersecting medical and financial questions to deal with, for example. Communication skills, you know, dealing with that person on the end of the phone, persuading the GP that this person really needs to be seen at home, that sort of thing. Sense of humour, highly developed capacity for tolerating chaos. That's why I don't score well on that one, but it's really important. You know, there are lots of really, really important things. So I just put before us a sort of like, in the ideal world, if only HR essential job requirement things looked like that, because that is what you need. And those and many others that I couldn't fit onto one slide are the amazing skills that and qualities, personal qualities that a good carer brings to the work. And we need to go back to the drawing board, even if we can get rid of these finance people and financialisation, we need to go back to the question of how we really value skilled care work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. And now to INSA. It's great because I don't know what's coming next. It's wonderful. How to be surprised.
Okay, thank you at the same time. Thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this panel, and thank you for the really interesting presentations. So I'm coming to today's topic from the perspective of an anthropologist. who's been carrying out long-term ethnographic research with working-class women on informal care relations and the state in this country. And what this means is I've looked at the care work that women perform inside their own homes mostly, so with respect to their children, their grandchildren, their parents, and others who they consider to be part of their households and homes. And what struck me when reading Lydia's book, so when reading your book, were the parallels that emerged between the situation that Lydia describes with respect to the paid care sector and some of the things that I encountered in my own research on informal care. So what I thought I'd do today is to broaden our perspective a little bit and ask what happens when we bring informal care into conversation with the story on paid care that we've been hearing about tonight. And to do so, I want to focus on what I take to be the most important parallel that I can see emerging between the two. And that is the systematic devaluation, or what Lydia calls institutionalized humiliation, of working class women's care work and their denigration and even penalization through policy and law, a process that I think has been exacerbated under conditions of welfare withdrawal and marketization, but that importantly, as Nikki had pointed out, precedes those processes as well. And what I want to suggest is that it's by focusing on the devaluation of care work, both with respect to paid care, but crucially also unpaid care, that we can push, I think, two central points that Lydia already puts forward in her book. First, her critique of the gendered and classed underpinnings of contemporary state policy. And second, really, the pressing need for genuine political reform. So I want to talk through these points by first, just briefly introducing the case of informal care and what I mean by that. And then I'm going to move on to some of the policy and legal context that affects the informal care sector, if we can call it such. And then conclude by talking a little bit about how I think ethnography and ethnographic work can foreground what we might want to call alternative political economies of care that can help us to push the case for political reform. Okay. Informal social care. So let me start then by just explaining what I mean when I talk about informal care. Now, many of the women that I've done my research with over the years have actually worked in the paid care sector. And in fact, when I was preparing for this event, I was going back to some of the women I've worked with, and I was just struck and surprised to learn quite how many of them have actually worked as carers in their lives. And a lot of them describe very similar things about horrible, exploitative work conditions that, you know, we've heard about tonight. But what interests me for purposes of tonight's lecture really are the acts of informal care that these women also engage with in their day-to-day lives. So as the main bearers of social reproductive responsibilities at home, they're typically involved in a myriad of care relations in and around their homes, including with their children, grandchildren, kin, friends, and neighbours. And these relations remain on the whole unpaid and invisible precisely because they take place inside their own homes. Now, sociologists of class, and Beth Skeggs has made really important contributions in this respect, have shown us that the value of informal care in working class neighborhoods is at once practical and moral. It is practical because surviving on your own is often not an option in a situation where life is tough, so where austerity politics have hit communities hard, and where jobs, precisely like those in the paid social care industry, are badly paid, precarious, and inhumane. And in these sorts of situations, people often get by precisely with the help of the support of others. So by living in often quite fluid and collaborative household arrangements that tend to cut across generational cycles, and in which borrowing and lending money, cohabitation, and other forms of sharing and caring are commonplace. But caring for others is not just a practical imperative that is necessary for economic survival. It also, I think, offers people a sense of moral value in the face of persistent stigma. And again, Bev has written a lot about this. And I think the women in Lydia's book also make this point explicit when they speak about the care work that they do as something that actually has intrinsic value and that is premised on a recognition of shared vulnerability of their own lives and the lives of people that they're caring for. Similarly, the women I work with think of themselves as good persons and as worthy citizens, not necessary because they meet society's dominant ideals of deservingness, often they don't, but because they contribute to their homes and communities through these everyday, unpaid, and often invisible acts of care. So how then do these sort of everyday and often unrecognized understandings of care sit with policies and laws? Now, I think what Lydia shows us so forcefully in her book, and we've been hearing about it tonight, is the dire situation that paid carers are facing today, and how this is the outcome of both deeply gendered and classed policies and laws that have ultimately facilitated and legitimized privatization. Now, of course, the story of paid care is different from that of informal care, in that informal care, precisely because it's unpaid, can't be commodified in the same way. But what I would suggest is that on a deeper level, these sorts of gendered, classed, and market-driven logics that Lydia describes in her book have similarly impacted on how policymakers and legislators tend to view and have acted towards working-class women's informal care. So take, for example, the case of public policy discourse, and the media plays a crucial role here. With the decline of welfare provisions since the 1980s, what we've seen is a resurgence of stigmatizing discourses surrounding working-class parenting, in particular around issues of single motherhood. And these discourses attack precisely the practical and moral value of the care work that they perform. They do so by presenting the working-class woman, in particular the mother, not only as the anti-mother for bearing too many children, often without a male breadwinner, but also as the anti-citizen who drains public resources. Meanwhile, the devaluation of working-class care is often legitimized and enforced in practice through policies and laws. Working-class mothers find that their intimate relations of care with kin, children, and household members become the object of unwanted intervention by the state in ways that don't always apply to the same extent to their middle-class counterparts. And there are lots and lots of examples of this. So, for example, when you take the case of public welfare access to benefits, today, market-driven, means-tested benefit policies that many of the working-class women that I work with depend on for their everyday survival also force these women to open their homes to official scrutiny. So the state comes to dictate what relations within a household it considers to be legitimate, and it does so by typically prioritizing single welfare claimants over the kinds of collaborative household arrangements that a lot of these mothers or women live in. Furthermore, neoliberal policies of law and order tend to turn women's relations with their children and household members into grounds for collective punishment as they expose women to the collateral consequences of harsh policing. So this happens, for example, when women face evictions from their socially rented homes because they have a household member, typically a child, a teenage child or partner, who becomes implicated in so-called antisocial or criminal activity. And perhaps, just to give you one more example, most recently under the shift to so-called austerity politics, policies like the bedroom tax have further reduced social housing tenants' autonomy over their own homes by defining what constitutes an adequately sized home for those who depend on housing benefits. And I think what we can see in all of these situations is that the effects of very disparate kind of policies and laws are both classed and they're gendered. So they're classed because they tend to target areas of policy making that typically single out working class citizens as their main recipients, social housing, welfare benefits, austerity politics, even criminal justice policies. And they're gendered because they tend to penalize everyday processes of social reproduction that are typically the domain of responsibility of women or working class women. Okay, so where then does this leave us and what are the possibilities for the future? I'm going to come to some concluding thoughts for the last minute or so. So Lydia in her book is very clear on the need for urgent political reform in the labour market, and Kevin has echoed some of that, so we've heard about the need to reverse, for example, an ingrate sex discrimination within labour market policies and a genuine enforcement of equal pay. I think what my ethnography is adding is the need to actually push the case for reform, both within labour law, but crucially also beyond labour law. So I think if we want to recognise the value of care across the spectrum, so, you know, by that I mean a sort of value, the value of care both in its paid and unpaid capacities, we have to take account of how actually a whole range of policies, including with respect to the benefits system, you know, housing, criminal justice, all these other domains, contribute to the marginalisation of working-class care. But I think perhaps most importantly, the case for political reform goes beyond making specific recommendations for particular areas of policy and law. Rather, what I read in Lydia's book and what I think is confirmed by other work that's being done in the field is really the need to rethink the very basis of our political economy by foregrounding what some people have come to call political economies of care. I think this might seem illusionary or utopian at first sight, but the experiences of working class mothers show that it can be done. So for them, as I've said, the labour of care is not something that can easily be turned into a source of profit-making or profit accumulation. It is, above all, a practical and a moral activity, which is founded, like I've said, on a recognition of mutual vulnerability. And I think it is precisely by reconnecting this sort of practical and moral value of care, as it is advocated by the women, with the political and economic conditions in which they live, that we can begin to formulate these sorts of alternative political economies of care. Political economies that push against the ever-increasing drive towards profit-making and commodification, which reject the logic of penalization and ever-increasing state control that these women are exposed to, and perhaps most importantly, which reinstitute care as a fundamental public good. Okay, thank you. I'm going to stop here.
Thank you. Before we open out to questions, I just wonder if any of the panel want to respond to anything.
Anybody else has said? No?
Okay, well, Neil, you've got microphones over there. If you'd like to ask a question, please put your hand up. One's going up straight away, Neil, down here. Gentleman in the hat. And if you could say who you are so we know where you're coming from.
Dr. Keith Postler, former guest lecturer here at LSE. I want to ask a question that picks on one word, law, from the topic of the evening. The conditions that we've heard about would seem to me, in a naive way as a non-lawyer, to be something that could fall under some kind of international or supranational even court or instance that would declare the system rather than the treatment of the people as unacceptable, not lawful. And this was done, for crimes of humanity after the Second World War and so on. Why not? Why isn't it treated, or why don't we see this kind of action, and is this kind of action due to or lack of action due to things of which I'm totally unaware as a non-lawyer?
That's great, thank you. So crimes against humanity, I'd say most definitely, kind of killing people is pretty significant. There are three legal theorists on this panel, so I'll pass the question over to them. So Lydia, would you like to start?
That's a really good point. Mm. And last year, the UN investigated the UK in relation to the Convention on the Rights of Disabled Persons and was absolutely scathing that the UK have been completely negligent in their responsibilities under that convention. It had some attention in the media. It's a fantastic report. You can look online. It covers issues to do with benefits for disabled people. It covers issues to do with social care, access to employment, issues to do with the bedroom tax, all sorts of things. So I think that was a really significant political event that happened, because it was the UK was the first country that the UN have investigated in relation to this convention, because the Convention on the Rights of Disabled Persons is quite new. The difficulty with international instruments is to do with their enforceability. And whilst it is very important that there is high-level condemnation of what is happening and that people speak out about injustice, I think what we need to see is grassroots voices coming together to mobilise for more power for people that are being taken advantage of. So more power for disabled and older persons, and also more power for care workers through a collective representation. And that, you know, the history of the 20th century certainly tells us that that's how working class people gain rights and gain access to resources, is through political organisation collectively.
Okay, would you like to respond any more?
I'll just briefly, I mean, I think there is a, I'm not a legal theorist, but I think there is a risk of overcomplicating what is actually also a moral issue. And I think really it would probably be much simpler to make sure that politicians understand what this system is, that ultimately they're responsible for this system, that the system is no longer acceptable, and actually they do have the means within their power to change it.
Yeah.
They have the means and the resources, because if these companies can provide social care and extract billions of pounds, then governments and councils can provide good social care for on a non-profit basis.
I mean, I think although I'm a lawyer, I basically do see this as a moral and a political question fundamentally. But just one sort of point on your very good question. You know, one of the ways in which legal regimes do badly in holding bodies and groups and people to account is that the way they define the objects of regulation or the holders of legal accountability are very often kind of elusive. So it's either individuals or it's, in the case of international law, it's the state. But here we have quite a lot of actors who are sort of slipping through the regulatory net in a way. So there is a bit of a vacuum, and I think Lydia's absolutely right. International law, with a few exceptions like the regime for crimes of against humanity and now international criminal law to some extent, international law is really has persuasive and political force rather than directly enforceable legal force.
Okay, so any more questions? Yes, if you'd like to. Who's got the microphone now?
Hi, my name is Chimenda. I just want to ask about the current care system in this country, because in the last decade, I think, there's been a big move towards what they call personalisation. I'm sure you'll be aware, but for others perhaps, that instead of... I mean, the idea is that in the past, older people would be, you know, living in homes long term, and now the idea is that older people can choose how the money is spent and they can buy in services from wherever. And that, at least originally, had a fair bit of support from some organisations representing or claiming to represent people in care. It does lend itself quite naturally towards fragmentation and towards marketisation, because you've got all these different providers and people can basically choose what they want from who they want, at least in terms of what's available, with the money the council will make available to them. What I'm wondering is, can that sort of choice-based system be brought into non-marketized, if you like, state-led structure and system, or does taking the private sector and taking the market out of the care system necessitate a move back to the old system of kind of, you know, big care homes and everyone in it and that sort of thing?
Okay, I'll kick off on that one, in the sense that having to deal with my mother's choice, first of all, you have to be able to see, you have to be able to write, you have to be able to use a pen, you have to be able to use a phone, you have to be able to hear. So for a lot of people, just accessing what's out there is an impossibility. To actually access somebody to help you access is also an impossibility. So if you don't have people to actually do that for you, choice is a completely vacuous term. And that's the kind of person who would slip under the net. And as we've seen with the kind of massive increase in deaths amongst the disabled, their complete failure to be able to access care is one of the key issues. So they literally starve to death. because they cannot even choose. They can't find anything. So access for me would be the key issue, which I don't think could be addressed with any system. You have to provide care, not ask people to find care. Would anybody else like to respond?
I think you're absolutely right. And the other point to that is by introducing choice, you introduce again a whole new layer of bureaucracy which takes funding out of service. So all these different providers have brochures and have marketing campaigns and they're doing all sorts to compete for the limited funds rather than put that money into care. But I'd also make the point that I think the return to public provision doesn't necessarily mean the return to a kind of an institutionalised, you know, these huge, big, grey homes. I mean, if you look at some of the state provision in some other countries, particularly in Scandinavian countries, it's tremendous that the care that is available now, and there's no reason why modern progressive care can't be provided by the state.
Okay, over here. Thank you.
Hi. Is it on? Yeah, can you hear me? I think I'm really interested in the parallels between the care of children and the care of the elderly, so that intergenerational element, I suppose. And I work in both fields, actually. I'm an early years teacher working with very young children. I spend most of my time engaged in informal care work. My mother was a carer. My mother-in-law is a carer, both home-based care and care in nursing homes and that sort of thing. There's a sort of a false division, I think, between looking just at care of the elderly and not bringing care of children into the debate. And I'd really like to see a much closer relationship and dialogue around that. And my second point is the discourse around equality. You know, you can, and gender equality, because you can only achieve gender equality when you move women away from informal care into formal paid care. So from informal work into paid formal work. I mean, is this a con? Is basically what I'm saying, because you're moving a lot of women into very low paid work, working with children in social care and with the elderly. That's not really the definition of equality that most people would aspire to. So we're sort of being fed a myth of progressive policies, getting women into more hours of paid labour in order to free them from the shackles of the home, and yet actually we're enslaving them in paid work, which is low paid without any protection of any kind. So, sorry, it's a bit of a convoluted question. But,
no, I think it's great, and I think nearly everybody on the panel has worked on that. So, Insa, would you like to begin answering that question, because you've worked a lot on that relationship?
Well, no, I couldn't agree more. I think you're right, there is a danger, you know, and I think this is, I mean, Lydia talks about a little bit in her book, and I think Nikki was also alluding to it in her talk, the idea that, you know, that they are very strong continuities, and that actually, you know, we need to address questions of gendered inequality that are much, much more fundamental than limiting our debate to the question of paid care. You know, that there are all sorts of debates that feminists have had about the idea of the privacy of the home and, you know, what happens in a domestic space and how that perpetuates gendered inequality. So I couldn't agree more, except to say that I think we shouldn't automatically assume that care work is a form of enslaving women, right? And that, and while it might be for some women, it certainly won't be for all women. And so there is a need to develop, I think, a kind of more sophisticated understanding of what we mean by care and the value of care when we're talking about it.
Well, I think you really just put your finger on why I feel we mustn't lose sight of the question of how we value care work and how we value the skills that go into doing good care work. And I think you're absolutely right that there is an extremely close analogy between these different forms of, you know, young people and older people care work, or disabled or sick people care work. I think the reason why the elderly care is salient at the moment, but I do think there are some reasons why that issue deserves a certain salience in the debate at the moment. partly because we had made more progress, not all of which has been rolled back on, in acknowledging the value and importance of the care of children through things like parental leave. It's not adequate, but there has been a greater degree of institutionalization, it seems to me. So if you face suddenly, as you know, many, if not most of us will at some time in our lives, suddenly an elderly person in our families for whom we have responsibility just suddenly having a crisis and totally needing our care and support, we will find it much harder to access support from our employer and ways of having leave if we're lucky enough to be employed in a, you know, safe and secure way than somebody who has childcare issues. So I think that there is, while I think they're really analogous, I actually think there is a bit of a lag between the way in which, so I think childcare is undervalued, but I think elderly care is even more undervalued, actually.
Dia, do you want to respond? Because I know you've worked on this.
Yeah, gosh, isn't it complex? I wanted to say that, of course, the issues to do with care in general are central and fundamental. So for example, where Nikki was picking up on the equal pay point in relation to privatisation, the problem is not the equal pay claims, but the framework of equal pay law, which make it so that when you move outside of a system where you can make these comparisons with a man employed in either the same work or equal pay for work of equal value, that there is no reference point for valuing care outside of being able to make this comparison with a man in the same employment. So it's a fundamental problem that feminism hasn't addressed and hasn't achieved is around this recognition of the value of care. But one of the things that I found really interesting in my research with care workers is that care workers for older people, really, the care workers I interviewed, really distanced themselves from care workers for young children and said that that was a job that they just could not do. And so from a kind of occupational perspective, they understand those jobs, looking after children and looking after older people, as being extremely different. And there are also issues to do with, for example, the personalisation point. We need to be mindful of the rights of disabled persons and the fact that disabled adults wouldn't consider their care to be similar to the care of children. So that's another complexity to introduce into it. And there's also the fact that there is something quite unpleasant about the way in which capitalism discards older people as being no longer economically useful. And so the care of children and their education and development is viewed very differently from a public policy and politics perspective, because they are the future workforce. It's very complex and really interesting and is going to keep us all very busy for a long time.
Okay, so we've got time for a couple more questions. Oh, sorry, over here.
Hello, my name is Debbie Ireland, and I've actually worked as a carer, both in for a not-for-profit organisation and recently for a live-in care company. And I'm not quite sure why Professor Lacey thinks that the recognition of all these qualities is going to make any difference at all. Every one of the qualities that she described were emphasised wonderfully by this live-in care company, and then the carers were given zero-hour contracts with unmeasured work, with absolutely unrealistic daily average hours agreements. And it made no difference at all what people think are the qualities that are necessary.
I think that's one for you, Nikki.
Well, I don't think that counts as recognising those qualities and valuing them properly, is all I would say. But, I mean, you're absolutely right. This is a major battle that has to be fought, because there's a lot of money and power at stake, and that's the That's the problem.
Okay, so time for one more. Yeah, there's a hand up there, one more question. Thank you. Oh, wait, just here in front of you? Not behind you, in front of you. Thank you.
Yes, I would like to take up the question of complexity as a major problem. Say this because my father was a relieving officer. He was, when he died, he was one of the last people still around until that point who had actually administered the poor law. And say what you don't like about the poor law, what was wrong with it, it had a glorious simplicity to it. He was responsible on his own for a union of parishes. He had to do everything, mental health, poverty issues, children, the whole lot. And everybody knew where they stood, and he knew where he stood as well. His job was to help these people, not to control them bureaucratically. And he had that glorious simplicity behind his role in the system, which I don't think anybody has any longer, really. So I think the historic basis before we had this complicated care system, this fragmented care system, really needs looking at to see what historical models we can come up with for the future.
Thank you. Kevin, you've been looking at different types of provision.
Well, I suppose the one thing that jumps out to me from that comment is the current progress of integration of health and social care, which should happen, and it needs to be advanced. I mean, we've been involved as a union in many models which are going to fail because it's been used as, because the title health and social care integration has been used as an opportunity to cut further staffing, cut further resources, and to create an even worse system. But where I'm based in Manchester, I mean, our directly elected mayor, Andy Burnham, stood on a manifesto of bringing social care staff into the NHS family. Didn't say into the NHS, but into the NHS family. And I think that's an absolutely crucial step. So not only would I argue that we need the public provision of social care, but it has to be incorporated into NHS, and that has to be incorporated into all other areas of state provision to get back towards that simplicity you talk about. Because it's crazy that a lack of beds in a particular Bupa home, for example, will create a bed crisis at a local acute hospital, and that isn't being married up. It's insane.
Anybody else like to respond to the desire for a simple state system?
Well, you're reminding me that there was a debate in the House of Commons on social care last week, and I was shouting at Parliament TV when the politicians were saying this is very, very complex, and it was all about social care for the future and what needed to happen for the future. And, of course, whilst analytically there are a lot of complexities, in another way, there is a simplicity about this. And I think it's important that politically that we don't overcomplicate things, which is that we need politicians to actually take action on this, to fund the system properly and to ensure that people's needs are being met. So I would agree with you that the appearance of complexity is often used as a massive excuse for doing nothing and for politicians to continue to kick the can down the road.
Do we need politicians involved, or should it be giving the people who administer it more power and more responsibility to get things done?
I think we need politicians involved because it's about taxpayers' money and about the responsibility of the state to us. And in terms of what we need from the state as a 21st century community of people, we're a community of people that is ageing, where women and men go out to work, go out of the home to work. And we need the state to provide for us a collective system through which care needs are met. Paid, unpaid, state-supported, not state-supported, in various different ways. But that is a major political demand that we need to be making on politicians and on the state, and to hold our representatives to account on it, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, I agree entirely. Somebody's made a decision to allow private equity to take 15% profit, so somebody has to make a decision to stop them doing so. So I think it's very much in the politicians' hands, and we need to lobby them to actually decide what type of care we want. So I'm going to finish by saying I do think this is, for me, the most important issue around inequality, one that always gets overlooked because of who performs it. But basically, we will be suffering at the lack of care. And if any of you have to go through what my mother went through, I would actually recommend that you try killing yourself beforehand, because it had everything in it in terms of complete humiliation, the most horrific way to end a life, and nobody should be subject to that. So when the nurses said you wouldn't put your mother in a care home that's not fit for dogs, even the provision outside of that was not fit for humans or dogs. So I think this is one of the most crucial issues that we have to confront. And I'd like to thank the panel so much for coming here tonight, for you to attending, for you to be here on May Day, a very important day. And also, I'd like to thank the events organisers from the LSE, who always do a superb job, and to Neil, who organised the whole thing. So thank you very much for being here, and thank you to our speakers. Mm-hmm.